Hi folks, hope you're well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all sizes and shapes up and down the country. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to talk to us about their lives, tell stories about what they do and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. This was definitely one of my favourite Banter panels in recent times because of the amount of good sense on show. So, you want to open a restaurant with a deep dive into the art, business, blood, sweat, tears and occasional cheers of running a restaurant in Ireland, recorded at the Ballymaloe Literary Festival in 2016. We were joined then by two people who certainly knew all about the restaurant business, namely Jess Murphy from Kye in Galway and John Farrell, the mastermind behind Dillinger's, The Butcher's Grill, Super Misu, Luna, 777 and other ventures in Dublin. This may be the most rock and roll and honest discussion you will hear about what it really takes to run a successful food gaffe. Hi everybody, welcome along to the final banter of the weekend here at the Garden Tent at Ballymaloe. So this panel is called, So You Want to Start a Restaurant, You Stupid Fucker. So what it is, this is basically a bluffer's guide done by two experts about why you open a restaurant. What are the obstacles you face when you decide to kind of get into the restaurant business? So we're joined by two people. On the far right, we have Jess Murphy from Kye in Galway, an award-winning restaurant, an amazing restaurant. Their fish fingers are incredible. Every time I've been in Galway, I've been Galway every year for court for the last couple of years. And fish fingers are first thing on my to eat list in Galway. Next to her, we've got John Farrell. John runs many restaurants in Dublin: 777, Dillinger's, Butcher's Block, Luna. Am I leaving out any? SMS.
That's it. Yeah, Survey and the Butcher's Grill.
Butcher's Grill. So please give a warm round of applause to John and to Jess.
Thank you.
Okay. That was the potted introduction for me. Tell me your real story, Jess. You can tell me how you got into food in the first place and what were you doing before you actually decided food was where you wanted to be.
Okay, well, I mean, I grew up in New Zealand, so I wanted to be a chef since I was like 7, so I really didn't give a shit about school. Absolutely not.
Well, why did you want to be a chef from the age of 7? Was it chefing rather than restaurant owning?
Well, I think my uncle, who used to drink quite a lot of gin down at the Bowls Club, I used to help him out on a Saturday, and he always
were you drinking gin?
Well, I was only a child, so I'd clear all the glasses and get about 50 cents and a packet of crisps and, you know, be delighted with life. But then just the way that it made you feel, like collecting glasses, looking after people, making sure people were okay, feeding them, you know, just actually looking after people. So apart from that, that was brilliant. And so I got asked to leave high school when I was about 15. And then I started washing dishes for about 2 years in this bar and grill called Rocks Bar and Grill in Hawke's Bay. So I was a kitchen porter there, and then I got boosted up to do desserts, which was basically a Mississippi mud pie microwaved in the microwave for 30 seconds, then brought out with a fan strawberry and some squirty cream. That was the highlight of my career at that point. And I was like, I really have to get out of New Zealand. Nothing's happening in New Zealand. I really want to go to Italy. I want to go to Europe. So on my 20th birthday, I asked my parents for a one-way ticket to Australia, to Western Australia, to my uncle's. And so I got the one-way ticket to Perth for my birthday, which was in February. I got a suitcase because they were like, Jess, what do you want for your birthday? I was like, well, I suppose I better have a suitcase. And off I went, and I haven't looked back. And I've kind of – I left New Zealand when I was 20, and I'm 37 now and live in the west of Ireland. I met my husband in Kalgoorlie in Western Australia out in the outback. So I just worked and worked and worked.
Okay. And like, yeah. You know, when you started in Kye, had you run any restaurants before then?
Yeah, quite a lot. Well, I was a head chef of a few restaurants in Galway. Like, I was a head chef of Ard Beer for years. And then I took a break and decided to become a cheesemonger, which was absolutely mental because it was me, Seamus and Ender.
Okay, yeah, we had Seamus on the last panel, so you have my sympathies.
Yes, and then I actually helped Seamus open their restaurant on the docks, and I was Ender's sous chef. And then obviously Ender, who's got a Michelin star now, was going more fine dining. And obviously I worked for Kevin Thornton when he had 2 stars. So I didn't really want to go down the Michelin kind of level again. Yeah. I felt like I was getting too, not old or tired, but it was just, it wasn't my thing, even though I do appreciate it. So I opened Bar 8 down the road. And then obviously regulars from Bar 8 who are florists, that had the florist that was in Kai, just went, we're retiring, do you want our place? And that's okay. How Kai started.
So let's pause it there before, as you're about to move into Kai and turn to John. What's your background, John? What were you doing before the restaurant began?
Carpentry. Well,
are you good at carpentry?
I thought so. but I couldn't afford to finish the class, so I was 19 years old and I went to an employment agency in Africa where I was living at the moment in a place called Newcastle in Jansenville. And there was two jobs going and your woman had the Rolodex. I'm 42, so I was 19 then. It was 92, I think. And one was an insurance job and one was a job to start in the kitchen. So I took the insurance job. And then 3 weeks later, I came back and I said, is that kitchen job still available? So I started there as a kitchen porter and basically worked my way up through the kitchen, got trained to be a cook, then moved on to the floor. So the first restaurant was a restaurant that I had braces on with badges, with a cap, and I had to stand at the door by this thing called the Salad Valley.
The Salad Valley?
Yeah, Salad Valley. You had to watch how much they dished up on their plates. After that, basically, how I started in restaurants, owning my own restaurants, was basically, money is a big issue. And it was the first restaurant I got was Mint in Ranelagh, which was Dylan McGrath's restaurant, which went into liquidation.
Yeah. Just pause a second before we get on to kind of Dylan McGrath and Mint, John. So between the time you were overseeing the Salad Valley in Africa and Mint, what happened in between? Because I'm suddenly going, there's 10 years in there.
Yeah, I'm not too sure, actually.
Okay, so that's a good answer. Not too sure. We move on to Mint then.
Yeah, so it was difficult because it was obviously I was working as a waiter, as a manager, and I was the first place I managed, I pretty much ran it into the ground. But it was a lesson that I learned once and I never did again.
Was that in Ireland or was it in Africa?
It was in Africa, thank God. So I made sure I wouldn't do it again. But then the challenge was educating myself in the legal side of things, like leases and how do I start a business, how do I set up a business. I knew the other side of it, but I knew I needed to educate myself on both sides in order to be successful and to push myself forward. So I took an interest and I thought I wouldn't really enjoy that kind of thing, and I do enjoy it. And so I managed to I managed to be pretty good at that side of things, which I didn't think I would be.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, I really enjoy design, and I still had that feeling of design and furniture design and carpentry. So that helped me realize what the places were supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And from having it on paper or having an architect give you a piece of drawing. Yeah, and so Mint was the first one, and then rolled off.
Yeah, so let's start with Mint then, because Mint would be a good story. You know, Mint is well known because you say Dylan McGrath was there. It was like it won a Michelin star, didn't it, at the start?
It did, yeah.
What did you find? Like, I mean, did you know Dylan beforehand, or where did you come across him?
No, he just kept asking me for his cheese trolley, and I kept explaining that it went into liquidation, and that I actually set up a wine company prior to owning restaurants, and my wine was in part of the liquidation sale, so, and plus he didn't own any of the restaurant anyway, so it wasn't his cheese trolley. But the cheese trolley wasn't there, which it should have been there anyway, but it wasn't there.
So
the liquidator has the cheese trolley. But I didn't know who Dylan was, and I'd eaten there twice and just met him. You know, he came to the table and the food. I thought the food was fantastic.
Yeah.
It was just unfortunate, I think. That had closed at that time. Okay. It was 2000. It was November. It closed in mid 2009.
Yeah.
And Dillinger's opened in November 2009.
Okay. Right. Okay. So we'll pause there because both of you obviously, you know, when you took over your restaurant, you're talking about design, you're talking about management, and like, I mean, from your point of view, Jess, when you moved yourself and your husband moved into Kai, you know, what were you thinking was going to be the biggest challenge, and what turned out to be the biggest challenge?
I think actually getting cash. was the biggest challenge because for me, like, I was always the one knocking on the door going, I've got an idea. I need 150 grand to build this. I want to make cheese. This is what I want to make. And I want to make a dairy. And I want to do this ice cream part. Like, so I always had plans and I was always, always knocking on Pat, my bank manager's door. So when I actually came to him with a realistic amount of money that I wanted to borrow, he was like, okay, sweet, let's write a business plan. I was like, what's that? So I went and got us 2 takeaway sandwiches and Pat actually wrote my business plan for me. And without that man absolutely having 100% like blinding faith in me, Kai wouldn't even exist. And he was like, that's fine. I was like, then obviously things would happen. Like I forgot that restaurants need a till and had to borrow a till off somebody for 6 months until I could buy. Like I was like, if you loan me a till, I'll buy like a really flash till in about 6 months. And people just believed in me. And it was just, I don't know whether or not it was a run of luck or they judged me on what I did before or I don't know. Everything just fell into line for me anyway.
Mm. I mean, obviously, like, I mean, the food was really good from the get-go. But, like, I mean, I'm curious about, like, the business plan that Pat, the bank man, just drew up for you. Did you find that it was enough? Did you find you had enough money or did you, like, underestimate how much you needed?
No, because how things work in Galway is you go to a Connacht rugby match and then you walk up Quay Street and then you find an architect that is on the dole because it's in the middle of the recession that is renting out his spare room and will design your restaurant for nothing because he hasn't got anything else to do. And then you just end up becoming best mates with him and he comes around for lasagna and he's designing your restaurant. Because we're all broke and it was Galway and it was crazy. Okay. Like we couldn't even, like when we opened, we couldn't even have a bottle of wine on the menu for over 50 euros because it'd just be obscene. It'd look obscene. Mm. So how we started off like that was, it was just luck of the draw.
Right. So then November 2009, your case, Sean, like you've taken over that premises, like prime premises in Ranelagh, you know, it's on the main street there, you know. Was it like, did you find then taking over that particular point that the estate agent was more willing to do you a deal? Were the prices good?
It went for 50,000 euro in liquidation and...
50,000 euros?
That's what it went for, yeah.
50,000? That all?
Yeah, well, it was
about... Should you put her hand in her pockets here and do a collection and pay for it?
Well, I negotiated with the liquidator and I got him at 65 and then I strung him along till the very end, till the dockets had to be signed. Went to the office and then just walked out halfway through, walked back in. He couldn't wait any longer for the money and we got it down to 50 and then signed it at 50 and used 2 SSI savings schemes called MBNA credit card company that I had, which I had a 15,000 euro limit on. And back in those days, MBNA credit cards, they had stupid limits on. And then I said I needed you to increase my limit to 35,000 quid because I wanted to buy, well, they said why, and I said I wanted to buy a car. And I said I'll pay it off at the end of the month and bring it back to 15,000. I didn't think they would, and they said yeah, okay. And so I wrote myself a check and I deposited the 35K into my bank. They took a long time to see that. And then I... and I was still short money because of the fit out and stuff, and then I needed 20 grand and I was literally down to the 3 days to getting the 20 grand and I didn't know what to do. And back I was still getting, used to get those letters from Bank of Ireland that would give you a pre-approval for 19,900 euro and you'd get it like this, bam, into your account. And I got one of those letters 3 days before, and so that's pretty much how I got I was a bit of a wing and a prayer.
Okay. So both of you then, like, I mean, kind of basically found your way through the recession. You found your way kind of like you could actually duck and dive. Let's call it duck and diving then. So when you've opened up for business, what did, like, you know, how quickly did it take for Kai to become a success, Jess? And define success as well.
Well, success is like, I mean, we're a 45-seater. You know, we do back-to-back sittings on a Friday and Saturday. It's becoming a Thursday night now. You know, we're pretty busy. We employ 22 staff. We're really happy. Like, it's pretty cool. So that, for me, is success, is paying people's wages, treating people fair. People want to move gaffs. You have enough money for them to pay their deposit for their flats, and then they pay you back, and they can go on holiday, and people put themselves through college. And so for me, that's success. But, I mean, we did loads of stupid shit when we first opened. Like, I said to Dave, because Dave was a fabricator welder, so Dave had never ever worked the floor. Only a few bits and bobs when we were stuck in our beer. But so Dave came straight from pattern engineering to polishing Prosecco glasses. So, you know, it was a massive transition, and I don't know how we actually did it. It was just blinding optimism. We're both pretty optimistic anyway. But you know, like, we closed Tuesday and Wednesday nights, and we only took bookings at 8 o'clock. I had no idea what we were doing. But anyway, we sorted that all out, and you know, there's loads of stuff, you know, feeding vegetarians that have never eaten meat chorizo before by accident because you didn't write it on the menu. You know, giving somebody that's allergic to dairy products, and then them pulling out an EpiPen, and then, you know, the trip advisors of my husband ended up in hospital eating here. It's all those things that just about destroy you that make you stronger, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll come back to you. You mentioned one thing there I definitely want to come back to, Jess, and that's TripAdvisor. Back in your case, John, so Dillinger's opens, you've got your credit cards maxed out, you've your SSIA scheme, which is Charlie McCreevy's giveaway money, you've used everything, you put it all into Mint. That was 2009. 7 years on, I mean, you've now got a chain. So was it from the start, was your intention to kind of like get more places, or was it the case we often find with people who end up with multiple venues, happy accidents?
No, I was managing a place just before Mint called Il Primo, which was I owned it. I kind of co-owned it for 3 years, but I worked with him for 7 years, and he had there was a lot of well-known people and a lot of famous people who went through the restaurant, and so I got a good bit of goodwill from them coming to Dillinger's in the beginning. But to be honest with you, it was obviously there was a lot of attention on a Michelin-star restaurant in the recession closing. What are they going to put in place of it? And then a casual dining restaurant opens. So that I got a lot of free PR from that side of it. So it was full on from the second day. Mm. It was two sittings. It was the head chef was Temple from Town Bar and Grill, which had closed. So he was my head chef. So there was a lot of experience. Grogne, who used to manage Mermaid Cafe, who managed the Winding Stair, was the manager, and I kind of decided not to work as a manager in the restaurant, just to remove myself from it. And I kind of lost myself a little bit for the first 6 months because I didn't have anything to do, really. But so I just would pop in, and I did the pass a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But I purposely removed myself from it so that I could work on other projects. But the one of the reasons why it was so busy in the recession at that time was there was a lot of attention on obviously who it was there before, because Dylan obviously got a lot of PR, and there was a Michelin star restaurant that I think he wanted in quite a short time.
Yeah.
And then it all of a sudden it closed, so so there was that there, and then exactly 11 months just over 11 months the Butcher Grill opened. And it was the same story, and it was just across the road, really, 100 meters down.
Mm. So okay, we talked a bit about like the mechanics of opening your first place. The one thing we haven't mentioned is the food. From the get-go with Dillinger's and with Kai, did you both know, sorry, you, Jess, did you know what you wanted to serve? Were you very clear about that from the start?
Yeah, well, basically the whole of Kai was the slow food ethos. Like, that's what the ethos was, and, like, use local food and support the Galway network of farmers and, well, you know, cheesemakers and stuff like that. All the businesses on the street need to be supported. So obviously from Kai to Ernie's to the Laundrette to Health and Herbs making our teas, the Laundrette on the corner doing our washing, to Ernie's buying the spuds from Ernie's, to actually having that local community in the recession joining together and starting to spin this business that we're actually all working for each other in different ways. Mm. So, you know, that was it, really.
Yeah, and with Dillinger's then, you said, like, I mean, casual dining. Did you reckon at that stage you didn't want to go to anywhere? You kind of wanted to avoid the kind of Michelin star thing. That's something that Jess mentioned earlier on as well.
Yeah,
well, away from that.
Well, no, it just closed, so it went into liquidation, so I thought it wouldn't be a smart idea. Plus, I wouldn't have control over the kitchen as much.
Yeah.
But I do give them as much freedom as they like, and we're a team and we work as a team. But the casual dining can be it's just about food. You know what I mean? It's not about the way you're presenting it sometimes and fine dining and silver service. It's about you sitting down, relaxing, having a good time, and the food and the quality that you get is really good. And it's Dublin's a little bit different about produce, because I think here, down here, you know, you'd have a lot more, and in Galway, you'd have a lot more local artisans, and so that wasn't as big back then. And obviously, we support local produce as much as we can. But it's a skill set that the people have in the kitchen, and it's knowing where to get that skill set, and it's tapping a network of people, and having worked in Dublin for a certain period of time, and knowing who's good and who's not good, and where is somebody at their game. Mm. And if you don't know that, then you're going to be a little bit lost. And also, food critics don't give you a lot of time, and you could end up, you know, being busy in the first week or so, and not being ready for it. So it's important to actually know what's going on in the scene, and also traveling, and also making sure that the people that you have with you have traveled. You know, which is great in your case.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, but in both your cases, I mean, you talked earlier on just about 22 staff, and you've kind of like talked as well about the importance of staff. Obviously, you had Temple at the very start. Right now, though, this has come up at a couple of panels this weekend about like how hard it is to get chefs and how hard it is to retain people. When you were starting out, was it the same way, or did you kind of find people were coming around to you because of the evangelism in your case, or because of your reputation in your case?
Well, for me, obviously, being on salary all my life of working 75 hours a week for near up to like €450, in some jobs it was €250 a week for 70-something million hours. So obviously I totally turned that around, so all my chefs get paid by the hour now. I have a huge support network. Trying to find chefs, it is hard. A load of chefs fly over to me all the time because I always get female chefs, where I wouldn't mind a few blokes, but it just seems to be a female kitchen at the moment, which is really weird. But yeah.
Well, it certainly is, because, there was a panel here yesterday by Malou about, just that how hard it is to get women into the business and how hard it is to keep women in the business. But, you've got a fully female kitchen, have you?
Well, our pastry chefs are men, and most of the women do the night work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which is kind of opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah, and same with me cooking and Dave on the floor. Every time we go to, events or anything like that, sure, they always talk to Dave first because they think Dave's the chef, you know. So, you know, that's actually got better over the last 10 years in Ireland, thank God.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's getting better. But it is. It's gut-wrenching work. It's hard. I still work 12 hours a day. So there's no getting away from it. But, you know, now that you get a bit older, you have to actually get away from being that hothead control freak to actually having the ability to train people that are actually going to be better than you, but guide them in the right direction of teaching them to be better than you. And my golden rule is, if you leave Kai, you're only leaving Kai for a better place than Kai. You are not going down, you are going upwards where you want to be.
Yeah. Do you think as well, that was the way you were trained in the kitchens that you learned about? Was that the way? And remember as well, just now, before you answer this question, this has been recorded for a podcast.
Yes. Well, then, no, that wasn't how I was brought up in kitchens, no.
That's a lovely diplomatic answer.
Yeah, and basically I didn't have a name either.
Okay.
My name would be various things.
Yeah, fair enough. That's a very diplomatic answer. Well done. Great. So, John, in your case, did you find staff retention hard? Did you find, or was the case of, that Temple was able to attract in people because he was a hot young gun with an interesting repertoire?
Well, I hired him and I hired the manageress and I let them hire their own team. So I left it at that, and the only other person I hired was Leo, who's kind of my right hand man.
PR guru,
with all the restaurants. And he had a business called Free Range Holidays in Portugal, with his ex-wife, and they did vegetarian meals and surfing and yoga retreat. But so it was just that, and I let everyone, and that's the process that I would have worked with all of them.
Yeah.
I would have hired the key people and let them hire their own team, but it is hard now to get. I kind of find it a bit easier than some people, but there is difficulties, especially with cuisine like contemporary Mexican food, which was a pain in my bollocks initially because I couldn't get anyone to work in the. It was hard. I didn't make any money. Well, I made money, but not as much as the accountant wanted me to make. But it was.
And that you're talking there about 777. I mean, that's a small restaurant. You know, you haven't got many covers there. 24, 28?
No, 50.
50, okay. So you're squeezing in a lot of small people then. So it's like, I'm curious then about that expansion. You know, you talked about you moved it, you got the Butchers across the road, and then like obviously, I'm trying to think, 777 was next, and then you got all the stuff down Drury Street Car Park. Did you find as you were expanding that it was easier to get money, that you weren't kind of like maxing out your MNBA credit cards?
No, I just went over budget all the time until I used a lot of the builders, the same carpenters, the same plumbers, the same kitchen people, and what I do is they let me pay a deposit and let me pay them over 120 days, and sometimes I'd stretch them a bit more, but I wouldn't have to really lend from the bank, so I didn't lend anything for Dillinger's, for the Butcher Grill. Or for 777. The first loan that I took out was really for Super Masu, which was small. But the back then, what was happening is the builders were bankrolling you, the carpenters, the construction companies, essentially, that you'd built a relationship with over the years. So it's not the same now. Now it's that, you know, they want the money up front. The banks are loaning slightly more. Business plans have changed. They're not like 10 pages long. They're 2 pages, keep it short and simple. They don't want to read 10 pages. But I'd say it'll take another year or so. But the it was the working relationships with the guys who built the restaurants. So,
so I mean, you've expanded. What about you, Jess? I mean, have you been tempted about expansion, or have you kind of, do you think like yourself and Dave are maxed out what you're doing right now in Kai?
No, not at all. Like there is, like, I'm definitely going to carry on. Kai's obviously, I wanted to wait a bit for Kai to see. We've been open 5 years now, so I just wanted to see if I'd give myself a complete mental breakdown over the last 5 years, and I haven't. I seem to be quite normal now. I think we are ready to expand, but it's still Goy as well. Like, so you have to be, Goy to me is very precious. So whatever you do, it has to be 100%. And the area that we're in Goy, is the west. Like, there was actually nothing down there. Like, you have to walk past the casino, the gay bar, the strip club, yep, to actually get to us. And then we're right next door to the church. So, you know, now that the area's, like, actually starting to boom, you know, it'd be nice to get something down there again. Okay. To do something small.
All right, but John mentioned kind of critics in passing, and you mentioned kind of like TripAdvisor in passing. So let's talk about how you, as kind of new restaurant operators, deal with that sort of thing: getting publicity, dealing with shit publicity, and dealing with the onslaught of critics in your first week or two.
Cool. Well, I mean, I've been caned once in the papers, quite a lot on TripAdvisor, but on Twitter. Sure, everyone gets caned, but like, what you do is, I think, as a female anyway, my whole thing to it was, now that I've given up smoking, to go outside and either chain smoke or run upstairs, have a bit of a cry, suck it up, get back downstairs and cook the best food that you've ever cooked, and get your driver team to push all the time, better and better and better, right, and better limits.
Does like mean bad reviews and kind of like bad sauce on kind of like TripAdvisor and social media? Does it have an effect on bookings? Does it have an effect on people's perception?
No, it doesn't. Like, TripAdvisor, absolutely not. It has no effect on bookings. I mean, maybe with the American clientele. Bad review in the newspaper is slightly, you know, worse, which I have had. But
yeah,
like,
great news from newspapers then.
Yeah. And but TripAdvisor, no, I don't think so. I mean, being number one on TripAdvisor doesn't mean anything to me, you know.
Okay, cool. John, what would you, like, what's your take on the critics and both social media and professional critics?
I've been caned, well, at school first, and then, then, loads of times, loads of times. I can swear, can I?
Absolutely fucking, okay.
I've been shafted like loads of times with bad reviews, but it's the first restaurant, Dillinger's, was like, I think for 3 weeks I didn't come out my gaff, and I just stayed at home. It's like, you know, and but then after a while, you get a thick neck and you just put your head down and you realize what matters and what doesn't really matter and what's actually affecting turnover and what's not affecting turnover. And also the to concentrate on the what you're doing, what you're serving in your kitchen and on the floor, and that what you have integrity with what you're doing and you believe in what you're doing, and not worry so much about behind the scenes there, because there's people with double agendas as well, and there's people who have points, and it could be either or. And you know, if they have a point, they have a point. You're right. And so you suck it up and you just carry on. But in the beginning, it will sting you a little bit. And you know, but get over it. You know, drink a bottle of wine, go to bed, and stay in for 3 weeks in the beginning, and then get over it later on.
Okay. Excellent. Last questions then. I mean, like, you know, if there are people in the audience who are thinking about opening restaurants, what are the kind of things they should think about? Should they immediately kind of stop thinking about it? Should they develop a harder neck? Or like, I mean, what are the things that surprise you from running restaurants that you've had to deal with?
Myself. Well, I worked until I was 36 was the first place I actually owned. But I worked hard and I purposely removed myself from the business, and I hired people, and my job was to motivate, to make sure that things were contemporary and that we're moving with, and to think of Ireland and Dublin as like the world, and not think of it as just we're in Dublin. So that was my job that I realized, and it was I did it on purpose, because I'd worked so many hours and I wanted to try and change what I was doing. But it's you're gonna it's hard work. You're gonna work a lot, and you're gonna the legislation side of things is crazy. You may have to end up putting in like ancil systems, water mist systems that you don't budget for, that
toilet
cost you thousands. Yeah, I mean, all sorts of things. I mean, it's just so there is legislation side of things through DCC, and there's DAC certs, which came into regulation in 2010. There's fire certs that you could have an ancil system before, but now you have to have an ancil system and a water mist system if you want an open plan kitchen, which is costing you thousands, may cost you another 10,000. There's a lot of that side of things that you may not realize that you're going to be dealing with these things that take a long time, and also like just with what you want to do, your concept needs to be you need to I would single on a one idea that's got strength that you can focus on, that has an identity that's strong. So it's not just a trip around the world. It's you have an identity. Somebody says, I want to go to a steakhouse, I want to go to a diner, I want to go to a contemporary Mexican, I want to go to a seafood cafe, I want to go to an Italian restaurant like Luna. You know, it's you got to market there, and so focus on that, and then also it's good if you know this legislation, because your architect doesn't know it sometimes. Well, does know it, but follows it ridiculously. So it's good to know these things. So a bit of education on that side would definitely help you, but it's not an easy job.
Okay. So education and focus. What about you then, Jess?
There's loads of weird things that like it came about when we first started. Like you have to pay for the radio, you have to pay for music, yeah. And then somebody was like, "I was like, how do they even know we're open?" Like knocked on the door and was like, "Can I have a check for 250 quid?" You're like, sweet, well, haven't got the till yet, like.
That's Imro.
Yeah, and then, like, water meters. And you're like, what do you mean you have to pay for water? And then, what's with the water protests? I'm getting confused that we're paying for water already, but yeah. Then all that kind of stuff. And then one toilet is only for 24 people. Did you know that? I didn't know that. So you have to have one toilet for staff and one toilet for every 24 people that come into your gaff. Sinks don't come with plugs. Pot lids they're actually more expensive than actually you can't buy a pot and a lid. You have to buy a pot and buy the lid. Same with containers. You have to buy a plastic container and the lid. All these little things were, mind-blowing to me. But, you know, thank God there's Dave, because that's all I think about really.
Okay. Excellent stuff. That's a good run through things. Please give a round of applause to Jess and to John.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
Thanks to John and Jess for joining us in Ballymaloe and being so honest. And thanks to Rebecca and all her team for their hospitality and help with the Banter series at LitFest. The Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter. Plus, you can also listen back there to all the Banter podcasts to date. We're back in Ballymaloe in May for LitFest 2017, so check litfest.ie for details. We'll be back here next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.